because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
I'm Steve Wallers.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's look at this week in politics in the Capitol. J.R., the hammer came down on the Veterans Administration in a U.S. Senate committee hearing at the Toma Hospital. It came down administratively and it came down politically with the release of this 357-page report. You're so busy you probably haven't had a chance to read segments of it.
I've read chunks of it.
It is truly chilling and frightening when they talk about the death of the first veteran, November 11th, 2007, 2009, the local union for Toma VA employees alerted the Veterans Administration Office of the Inspector General. 2009, a DEA investigator interviewed a pharmacist at the facility. 2009, the Toma Veterans Facility fired a clinical psychologist who committed suicide that day, and there was no investigation. This is amazing.
A doctor, nurse practitioner may have been impaired during interviews, and they didn't really follow up on that.
I found that memo. They didn't follow up on that either.
So, I mean, the theme basically from start to finish was the VA OIG dropped the ball. Office Inspector General did not do what it should have been doing, wasn't being a proper watchdog. There are all these warning signs, and calls were made, but all these federal agencies failed from start to finish in terms of addressing the problems going on. That's the bottom line of the report.
Yes, and this report was done by the majority staff of the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, headed by U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. And I just want to read one segment from the introduction. A moderately sized VA facility in a western Wisconsin city came to become known as Candyland for its easy access to prescription medications, allegations of drug diversion, opioid overprescription, retaliation, and mismanagement festered. As a result, veterans died. It was a pretty amazing hearing. You had a lot of VA brass come out from Washington. It was at the Toma Hospital. Senator Johnson chaired it because he chairs the committee. To his right, Senator Tammy Baldwin. Very interesting. And then the VA, to its credit, the deputy secretary, said, at the end of the day, we own this. We've had ample opportunity over a period of years to fix this. We failed to get it done. Now, let's listen. It was an opportunity for Senator Johnson to say, the minute, again, as he's told both you and I, the minute I heard about this, I was on it. So let's listen to how he summarized the failure of the VA Office of Inspector General.
Well, the Office of Inspector General under Richard Griffin was loyal to the VA instead of being loyal to the finest among us. The only hope we have of fixing problems is if you have an Inspector General's office, the independent, transparent watchdog actually doing its job. And what is very apparent in our 350-page report and the almost 4,000 or 5,000 supporting documents is that for years, the Office of Inspector General within the VA did not do its job. These tragedies here at Toma, I believe, could have been prevented had the Office of Inspector General done its job.
Okay, now let's talk about the politics. This report says, yes, progress has been made. The Deputy Inspector General was forced to retire. The people who managed the Toma VA hospital are gone. But now let's talk about the politics because, number one, as I said, Senator Johnson up for re-election. We'll get to that in a minute. To his right on the committee, Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, and it's in the district of U.S. Representative Ron Kind. So, J.R., what will this issue, how will this issue resonate or not resonate in the anticipated Russ Feingold versus Johnson?
Well, they set back to the reaction from the three lawmakers are there this week was that all things they've done since then to try and address this.
Yes.
Remember that Tammy Baldwin has taken a lot of political heat because she got this memo or a report about what was going on and her office didn't act on it until after it became public in January of 15. That's a huge political issue for her. Ron Johnson.
But she's not up this year.
No.
Excuse me.
Ron Johnson is up this year. There's a TV ad from Russ Feingold that knocked him quoting, using Ron Johnson's words from TV, a radio interview saying that, yes, they kind of didn't get to it, so fell into a black hole, if you will, where they couldn't get to some things during a transition period. Then you have Ron Kind, who now we know from phone records, he got a phone call, his office did, got a phone call from the veterans who died that lasted, I think, 7 minutes. So there all is a liability there. And it's also interesting was that Russ Feingold was asked about this Tuesday, whatever day it was. His reaction was, Wednesday. Well, one thing to note, I wasn't in the report. There's no mention of me
in this report.
And why that's interesting is because a conservative group has been running an ad featuring Ryan Honnell, who's a whistleblower of this whole thing, basically implying that Russ Feingold failed to act, and because he failed to act, veterans died, that he has culpability in this entire thing. So there are all kinds of political issues around this. It will be an issue with Feingold and Johnson. My impression is that Feingold is trying to neuter the issue or muddy the water, if you will, to say, well,
yeah,
they're saying, I got this memo. I never got the memo, so Evans, I got the memo. But they keep harping on, it says hand-delivered, so he should have known about this. He's saying, well, we didn't get it. And, oh, by the way, look at Ron Johnson's own failures with this. He was in office when those things were breaking, and he didn't act about it. So it's a bit of a football. I'm not sure there's any clear winner, if you will. But Ron Johnson is going to say, look, this is another example of how I took action. And I acted decisively about this issue once I knew the full depth of what was going on.
The TOMA hearing, which Wisconsin and I carried live this week, does it give Johnson the high ground temporarily? We're 5 months out from the election. But the publication of this report, does he have the high ground for this moment?
Well, it gives him an opportunity to say that I took action, and here's my here's the evidence of my action. I think he had did availability before the hearing starts. I'm going to be the watchdog of the watchdog, so he can say I took decisive action on this issue. So I'm not sure yet if anybody has any high ground on this issue, but it gives him something to point to of like, look, this is what I did.
Final question. 5 months out from the U.S. Senate election, the fact that you had real vets die, there's at least two of them mentioned, and a psychologist who committed suicide. Is this do you anticipate it to be a real live issue in the U.S. Senate campaign on November 8 when people vote?
Well, it's already been an issue. It depends if it's resonating with people, if it's moving numbers, and they'll keep pushing it in TV ads. The one thing I can tell you, though, is that whatever happens this election with this issue is only a precursor of 2018 when Tammy Baldwin is up, because she has the more of a direct link than Feingold, for example, in terms of like what maybe should have been done. She will get hit much harder on this, and this will be a central theme of her reelection campaign in 2018.
Okay, new subject. Paul Ryan, is it fair to use the E word, endorsed?
Yes, Donald? His office says don't use word games, this is an endorsement.
Yeah, so. But he said, I will vote for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I don't think in his op-ed piece with the Janesville Gazette he said E-word, did he?
No, but his staff has basically said yes, he is backing him. So,
okay, but you know how prolific his campaign staff is and the speaker's staff mm-hmm. is. We didn't get a press release on this. It was just kind of...
Well, he went to his hometown newspaper with an op-ed piece. Interesting, I saw on Twitter yesterday that Lyndon Johnson with McGovern told the two weekly newspapers in his home district where he lived in Texas that he's going to back McGovern. That's how he broke the news. He's going to support McGovern. So there's some odd parallel there in a way, if you will. Ryan's staff said, hey, he's a hometown guy. It's a hometown paper. That's how he decided to do it.
Okay, but I want to parse this a little bit. When you read what he said that Donald Trump as president mm-hmm. would be able to help the agenda of my U.S. House Republicans.
Make it a reality.
Now, that's hardly a four-square Donald Trump waving the flag for president.
Oh, no. He was never going to be waving the flag for Donald Trump. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But this is the endorsement that had to happen eventually. But it also disappoints kind of Ryan's conservative intellectual true believers, if you will, who are of the mindset of, I cannot stand, you know, Donald Trump. I can't get on board. I'm never Trump.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this independent guy looking at running with Bill Kristol's support. I'm looking for an option. I'm never Hillary. I'm never Trump. What am I going to do? Those folks are crushed this week because Paul Ryan was on the point to say, look, well, Paul Ryan has endorsed Donald Trump, so if the Speaker of the House has endorsed him, I have cover, if you will, to hold back. Also prepared a cover for his members to say, well, I've got such concerns. He still left some wiggle room, though, that if you are a Republican in a swing district and have some Trump issues, you can say, I'm still trying to get there. I want to see this, this, and this. Like, much like Paul Ryan, it's a process. Once I get the assurance from Donald Trump that he's there, then I'll be able to be on board. Now, what's interesting is the evening after Ryan endorses him or supports Trump, Trump goes out and talks about the Mexican heritage of a judge in his Trump University suit.
Yes.
And just basically blows, you know, any hope you had if you're a Republican that Donald Trump was going to play nicer, if you will,
right,
or drop the rhetoric that is racially tinged, went out the window right there.
And that is rhetoric that at one point, 2 months ago, Ryan called him on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2 or 3 months ago, he held a press conference to say we need to be better than this as we conduct the campaign for the presidency.
If you read the op-ed piece, Ryan says, I will still speak up when I need to, essentially. That if they're, he's still going to create room at times because there's this dual thing for Republicans of Trump is your nominee, all right? And he's going to drive a lot of things this fall. If he craters, you're going to see a wipeout down ticket that will hurt you. So you have to, in some ways, get behind Trump to kind of for the good of the party, if you will. But at the same time, how do you create space when you need it to say, he said this, I'm not there. There we are two different people. How do you do that? That's going to be an issue. I mean, for Ron Johnson, who's said he supports, but you know he can pull back his support, whatever he said, he'll get asked, much like other Republicans, Donald Trump said this. What do you say now? You know, this is your nominee.
This is your person.
He's going to become an issue for Republicans up and down the ballot, at least at the federal level, of your nominee said this. What do you say about that?
But this op-ed piece in the Janesville Gazette allows Trump to say that he has been endorsed by the mm-hmm. Speaker of the U.S. House.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of the U.S. House, it was 5 p.m. Wednesday was the deadline to file mm-hmm. candidate registrations, nomination signatures, things like that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the four U.S. House members who having primaries. First, let's talk about Ryan versus Nyland. Bring us up to date on Ryan versus Nyland in the first congressional district.
So Nyland has filed. What's interesting with Nyland is that he has been very poor position in the polls. I think he was down 80-7, and when we saw the last week or two ago. He's not being taken seriously by people inside Wisconsin in the district.
Yep.
Now, he's getting national attention because you have these conservative outlets who want to raise a ruckus, who want to go after Paul Ryan because they're not happy about various things with him. Does a Trump endorsement calm that down? Maybe. But there are other issues that are going to go after him on. So he's a vehicle, if you will, to kind of rage against the establishment. But as far as a real challenge, nobody I talk to sees it yet that this guy's got any shot of beating Paul Ryan this fall.
Okay. And in the third district, the veteran Ron Kind picked up mm-hmm. a Democratic challenger from Myron Buchholz, if I'm pronouncing his name right.
Retired Eau Claire teacher.
I was going to ask about his pedigree.
Said he was inspired by Bernie Sanders. So you're seeing there are a number of primaries at state level as well, legislative level as well, but they're for different reasons. There are a couple, though, that are obvious Bernie Sanders type. You know, I'm more progressive than this person is in office, and I'm going to rage against the Democratic establishment. This guy is inspired by Bernie Sanders. Kine has a kind of a moderate reputation, if you will. He's not a burning progressive. Bernie Sanders won his district overwhelmingly, much like he won most of the state. So I don't know if that's going to be a big issue for Kine. He's been around for 18 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 18 20, or 20.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Now, this Toma call, has this become a political issue for him? Possibly. You know, we have to watch that. But Ron Kine has a boatload of money in the bank. He got a lot of positive ads to pump up his name ID. By the way, there's nobody else running against him. If he clears the primary, he's got a free shot come November. So I'm not sure what to think yet about that primary, if it has real legs to it. Because what can he raise?
Right.
You know, you can have a lot of grassroots support, but if you can't get on TV and build your name ID,
yep.
You're talking a district that stretches from like west of Madison all up the western side of the state. That is a huge district that covers two media markets. Well, if you combine Eau Claire, La Crosse, if you separate those two, Madison, La Crosse, and Eau Claire, how do you advertise your name out there? You can do a lot of doors. You can't do that many doors between now and August 9th.
And let's be clear, we're talking about primary challenges. Mm-hmm. We're not yet into the November 8th election. Fourth District, City of Milwaukee, Congressman Gwen Moore, again being challenged by former State Senator Gary George.
Didn't go so well last time.
I didn't see that one coming, but he didn't do very well when he challenged her in the primary 2 years ago.
20% of the vote, 25%, maybe something like that.
So why is he doing it? Why is he back?
Because he's Gary George better than I do.
Because he's Gary George.
Because he's Gary George. I don't know. I don't see what's changed from 2 years ago. It's what would be a reason to go after him now versus what's changed? What gives you a new argument, you know? She hasn't done enough. He tried that argument last time. You know, there's more violence in Milwaukee than 2 years ago. We see more violent crimes. Maybe he may, but is that a congressional issue? Is that a mayoral issue? You know, what's the what's the path to victory for Gary when he got beat so badly 2 years ago?
Yes, and as it is with Gary George, former chairman of the co-chairman of the Joint Finance Committee, you never really know what it is with Gary George. So he's back. Seventh District, Sean Duffy being challenged by Republican from Superior. I'm going to guess at the pronunciation of his name, Rehala. You know anything about him?
No, nope. I mean, you see these flyers once in a while. Duffy has, much like Hine, has a very healthy war chest. He has done a good job working that district. I mean, for a guy who in 2010 Dems dismissed as like, oh, he's just a reality TV star, he's never going to be mounted to anything, he's done a good job working that district. It also has made more Republican for him, by the way, after the maps are redrawn for 12 elections. I don't sense he's in any real trouble at this point.
Well, and when we covered him at the Republican State Convention, boy, he was feeling his oats. He didn't act like he is in great fear of...
There's been a lot of talk about him running in 2018 for the U.S. Senate, so he is something to keep an eye on, a possible Tammy Baldwin challenger in a couple of years.
Okay. Now let's talk about, there are 16 state Senate seats up on November 8th, and 16, and six of them, there's one candidate filed, and they're going to walk in. Republican State Representative David Craig is going to walk into the Senate seat of Mary Lozick. Alberta Darling does not have an opponent. Let's go back to 2011. Her recall, she was a target of the Democrats. Now she's getting a pass?
Look at her district in 11 versus her district now. It's vastly different. At that point, it was a Republican-leaning seat that in the right environment with the right candidate, you could make a good run at it. Now it is deep red. It is not a competitive seat, and there's almost no chance of a Democrat beating Alberta Darling in that seat.
Okay, now Dewey Strobel won a special election. Same thing?
Super deep red seat.
Okay, that's why he's getting a free ride. Mark Miller and Fred Risser?
Super deep blue. Okay. They're not competitive seats. I mean, Fred Risser's seat is basically the Isthmus of Madison. That is, I think, one of the most liberal state Senate districts in the entire country. You know, you're not seeing a lot of Republicans coming out of the woodwork on Willie Street, Madison, to vote for a challenger.
Okay, and then the final state senator who's unopposed is Bob Wirch in Kenosha. I thought Kenosha could be more competitive. I mean, Reince Priebus once ran against Bob Wirch.
But remember, when Reince ran, those seats were different because it was Wirch's seat was Kenosha County, the city of Kenosha and the county. And then the Senate district was Racine and the county. Now it's the cities of Racine and Kenosha, and all the county pieces are in a different Senate district Van Wongard has with a slice of Racine in which he lives. They're just a very deep blue seat that you're not getting a good chance to win. Now, Joe Winicky, former Democratic Party chair, he's always argued to me that a rising tide lifts all boats, so try and fill every seat you can just in case. But you can tell this year that both parties aren't really taking that tact, if you will.
Yeah, I agree. And then we've talked about the two Senate Democrats who face primaries. Lena Taylor faces Representative Mandela Barnes. We've talked about that. And Jennifer Schilling is being challenged by someone who the La Crosse Tribune reports has got a few misdemeanor crimes.
And thinks that winning the Senate seat will be a springboard run for the presidency. So she will have more to worry about in the general election with Dan Kopanky, but maybe not much because it's a more Democratic seat than it was when Kopanky held it. And Kopanky's appeal in the 2000s was he was nonpartisan. But if you add in the fear over Act 10, when he supported Act 10, if you add in his 2010 congressional race against Kind, the ethics complaints filed against them, the nonpartisan sheen of Dan Kopanky has basically gone away. Now, he may be able to catch fire and give a run for money, but most people don't think he really is in a position to win that seat right now.
And Kopanky's got to win his own primary to challenge Schilling.
The guy that was going to run in his primary, I don't think he filed signatures to get on the ballot or didn't turn him in, so he may not be challenged in the primary this time.
Okay, thanks for the correction. By the way, let's back up a little bit. A challenger in the Democratic primary filed against Feingold, but this is someone with no political pedigree, a political unknown?
I have not heard hide nor hair of this guy. So, I mean, again, like with the guy running Duffy, sometimes people take a flyer on a race and just file the file. So,
okay. Okay, now let's talk about the state assembly. Here's what intrigues me. You have 99 seats up. You have 17 Republican incumbents have no challengers. 16 Democratic incumbents have no challengers. Six other incumbents face only third-party challengers on November 8th. So let me do the math. 39 of these seats are already, for all intents and purposes, filled.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, the maps that were drawn after the 2010 census, there are roughly 51, 52-ish Republican seats that they should hold no matter what. I mean, like in a bad year, maybe lose, but there's a baked-in sort of majority. And what they did, which is part of this lawsuit that we've talked about, is they created really Democratic districts that, you know, kind of take Milwaukee, for example, and get as many deep blue districts in Milwaukee as you can, mm-hmm. but create then the suburban districts more Republican. So there just aren't really competitive seats in a lot of these places because you can't create a competitive assembly seat on the Isthmus of Madison. You can't create one in Washington County, Wisconsin. It just doesn't happen because of the partisan nature of the people who live there.
Well, okay, but now I want to dive deeper. And here's what I find really intriguing. Five incumbent Democrats, either in Milwaukee or the Madison area, have challengers. No Republican incumbent legislators have challenges. So let me ask you, what did Representative Zebnick, Zamarripa, Pope, Subek, Leon Young, and Sinicki do to get challengers?
Good question. There's not really a common theme. Like with Subek, the guy that filed against her, he's a self-described Bernie Democrat who told me that Dane County Democrats are fighting hard enough for progressive values, and his argument was, if Dems just worked harder, they could beat Scott Walker, which I think the Dems would say, well, Scott Walker's many millions of dollars he's raised would say something different about that, but that's right. Besides the point. Right. With Zepnik, he got arrested for drunk driving last year. The attorney filed a run against him, filed not long after that, so that may be a part of the motivation.
She's a member of Milwaukee Police and Fire Commission. She's an attorney. She specializes in immigration law.
I think she also is part of the state party, Dem Party's Hispanic caucus.
I think so, too.
Joan Jo Costa, the woman running against her, she's been a perennial candidate, essentially.
Laura Manriquez.
This, I think, is her fourth run for the seat. Jo Costa beat her in 2010, came back again and again and now again. I guess in 2012, she lost with like 60, she got like 30-something of the vote, and they got a few more points in 24. Maybe she thinks it's a slow process to get there, but there's no sense that I get that she's considered a serious candidate to beat her. Now, she's got a group of people who vote for her, but that's a big jump from 33% or 35% to 50+1.
The one that intrigues me is State Representative Leon Young. Mm-hmm. If he's reelected, he'll be the longest serving member of the Assembly. I went back through the blue books, JR. Do you know the last time he had a challenger?
Oh,
1994. Mm-hmm. It's been 22 years since he's been on a post, and now he's got three of them?
And, you know, part of it is he has had some personal issues that have been kind of publicized, and it becomes an issue of you've been there for so long, is it time for somebody to kind of come in and try and take you out and move you aside? So that may be part of it. One of the people who filed is a public defender. It just depends. The other thing is always when you have three challengers to an incumbent, you split the anti-incumbent vote. So you're helping the guy out a little bit. If it were a one-on-one race, it might be a little bit more fun for sweat about, but with three, now, that's assuming all three put in work. If only one does, maybe different, but if you're splitting the anti-incumbent vote with three people, it almost is better for the incumbent sometimes, generally speaking.
Your thoughts on Representative Pope? She had two challengers. One of them didn't file. Now she has one.
Yes.
Luke Joseph.
Assembly Dems call him a fake Democrat. If you read his website, he sounds much more conservative than the party platform.
Yep.
So I'm not sure. I haven't been able to get in touch with him, what his motivation is. Christine Sinicki, the teacher who filed against her, is upset about a local issue with Milwaukee County. So I'm not sure how that translates to an assembly race, but that's part of her motivation in running against her.
Okay. Well, any big surprises in the filing of nomination papers, or have we hit the highlights?
I think those are the highlights. You know, I mean, Dave Craig, you know, with him.
Walking in?
Yes. Here's the thing. If you're going to beat Dave Craig in a primary, you have to get to his right. I'm not sure you can get to Dave Craig's right in a primary to beat him. So there was one guy who was like in school still. I think he may be in the National Guard or something, like 19 years old, and thought about running but never did. So, yeah, I mean, it's unusual when you have a free shot, basically, at an open seat to just walk in like that.
Yeah, okay. You and I, in a few hours, will be going up to the Democratic State Convention in Green Bay. I was intrigued. You know, we're taught as reporters to not make the news, but was politics is in the news because you want to explain what you won't be able to do at this convention?
Well, we do straw polls at every state convention. It's just a gauge where the conservative grassroots or the grassroots base is for the parties. We've done these each party convention for years, mostly without any incident. But we were told that we rent a table from them to do it. We were told we could do a straw poll, but not about the presidential race, like no questions about the presidential race. Well, obviously, as an independent news organization, we're not going to let somebody dictate what we ask about.
Right.
They're setting a party rule that says basically no beauty contest, no straw polls about the presidential
race. This is important. State or national party rule. National party rule.
They're saying that says we can't ask about it. Well, we're not going to agree to your conditions to run a straw poll. That's not something we're going to do. So no straw poll this convention. In 2006, I mean, Republicans asked us not to do it because, or at least with the AG's race, because remember at the time, Booker and Matt Holland running against each other and said, please don't ask about the AG race, and we declined then too. I mean, we're a news organization, not an arm of the party. So,
and you were able to do that straw poll.
Still did the straw poll, asked about that. In fact, I believe both Mr. Booker and Mr. Van Hollen voted in the straw poll. And I can't say they voted in their race, and there was a big drop off in the AG question that year. The party actively encouraged people not to vote in the straw poll because of that. But nobody's stopped us before from doing or tried to put an impediment like this.
What is the National Democratic Party afraid of in your straw polls like yours?
I think it's a question of unity. They want to present a unified message that they're coming out of this together
but
and behind, you know, and that's it. I don't know which is worse. Is it trying to tamp down a straw poll because you're afraid of it, or the message that could have come out of that straw poll of, well, the party is time. I mean, remember, we asked the Republican convention, if this is just after Trump had basically sealed the deal, hadn't won the nomination yet, but had become clear he's going to win it. If it's Trump, Clinton, who are you going to do? Vote for Trump, vote for Clinton, third party, sit it out. 80% of people took the straw poll, so they'd vote for Trump. I mean, that shows you there's still a healing process you need to go through. I'm pretty sure if we asked that same question this weekend, you'd get something similar. There's still Bernie Sanders Dems who are not ready to embrace Hillary Clinton, and that message is going to come out when you have a superdelegate debate this weekend, for example, about abolishing the system. Some people who were involved in that want to amend that resolution to say, superdelegates, you should cast your ballots 6-4 for Bernie because he won 56.6% or something like that here in the state.
So, do you think that's going to be the biggest fight in this convention over that resolution to abolish superdelegates?
Oh, it'll get the most attention, you know, because we're looking for, is the party unified, especially in a state like, and it, in some ways we're mirror image the Dems and Republicans, because Republicans, their convention was right after we were the epicenter of the anti-Trump effort, if you will.
Yeah.
Huge resources put in the state to stop Trump. He lost badly here, but then went on to win. Sanders won Wisconsin big. He had the base behind him. Go back to a straw poll a year ago. We asked about the presidential race. He was a surprising second, and a strong second, which got national attention of, well, hey, maybe this guy has some appeal to the progressive base we didn't really think about. And that was, you know, not just that straw poll, but that plus the rally in Madison with 10 or 12,000 people kind of began as part of the early Sanders surge, if you will, from long shot to he's got something going for him.
Well, as a Capitol reporter for more than 20 years, I find your straw polls useful and interesting, and I think they're healthy. They're just one indicator. Nobody says they're scientific.
No,
but I'm
it
sorry.
It gives you a feel where the base is about things, because you know these folks are—they're the ones who put up the yard signs, who man the phone banks, who write the checks, who come out, who give up a weekend to come listen to speeches for back-to-back days. They're your hardcore folks.
Okay, when Wisconsin and I did a preview of the convention with the executive director Corey Kozlowski, he predicted that there would be unity. So let's listen to Corey predict that Bernie Sanders backers, if Bernie is not the nominee, will support Hillary. How many of the hardcore Sanders voters will back Secretary Clinton?
We're going to come together as a party. 2008 wasn't too long ago. You certainly remember. There was a poll that was done in the heat of that race, and I think something like only 60% of the people who were supporting Hillary at the time said they would vote for President Obama. But then we got past that. All of those great Democrats, whether they supported, you know, then-Senator Obama or then-Senator Clinton, came together as a party and produced one of the biggest Democratic landslides in this country, elected President Obama overwhelmingly. This party is going to come together. There's no question. It has been a very vigorous primary, a lot of passions on both sides. But I think once people, you know, once we get past this, once they come together and realize what's at stake in 2016, they're going to come together. They're going to turn out to vote.
There's no stock picks this week. There will be next week.
Yep.
But we have to talk about one more issue that just emerged late. In an interview with the State Journal, Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb said, "My proposed 2017-2019 budget will not raise any taxes." The governor on the same day was then asked about it, and he said, "No, I'm not going to recommend any increase in the 30.9-cent gas tax last raised in 2006, in the $75 annual vehicle registration fee that you and I pay. I'm just not going to raise any taxes, but we're borrowing $850 million this year to keep highway projects Well, here, okay, I'm obviously a little bit exercised, but here's my question. Are you surprised that the governor again said, read my lips, no transportation tax and fee increase?
Look, kudos to the state journal for getting the interview, because that's good, you know, that Gottlieb is basically recognizing reality and sticking to what the parameters are. But Walker's been saying for a year now, I will not support a gas tax hike or a fee increase without a corresponding tax increase somewhere else. He has not wavered at any point we've asked him about this the last year. So nothing's going to change from now until the next budget. Now the question becomes, okay, well, what are you going to do? Because you have Republicans who, again, some Republicans speculate, saying, we need to look at raising revenues to pay for projects in our districts. You have a majority of Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee who have asked about a gas tax hike, saying, yes, we would support some kind of fee increase or tax hike to put more money into the fund. So what do? Do you bond again? Now, Governor Walker basically skipped a vertical building budget this biennium so that we could put all this bonding into roads and say, well, bonding's lower it's been in X number of years, which is true.
But we're not building any buildings.
Yes. So what are you going to do, Governor? What are you going to pare back road projects? Now, the zoo, I think, is getting close to completion.
18.
Something like that. So the final piece
is there.
That's
the east-west, and they put the north-south component of the zoo on hold.
So
that doesn't get done.
Does the zoo eat up everything? Does it get pushed off? What else gets pushed off? I know people want to redo 894. 94 east-west has to be, or they want to redo it between the zoo and the Marquette.
Yeah.
Does that get put off? Oh, by the way, if you live outside of southeastern Wisconsin, you have all of your projects you want to see done. Are you going to watch for two more years of southeastern Wisconsin sucking up all the dollars? I mean, there is the issue for when I talk to people about this, Republicans especially, is that there's no creativity, there's no answer to what's going to be done. So we're going to be stuck in hold again for another 2 years of transportation fund. Now, you can argue that maybe we build too many roads. Maybe it's time to pull back how many roads we build, how many miles we're doing. Road builders will say, well, those are good jobs that pay a living wage to people in Wisconsin, and we don't want to walk away from that commitment to those folks. What do you do instead?
But you and I have learned, covering that place, that unless you get the governor's support, you're not going to go out and advocate a specific gas tax increase or a vehicle registration fee or tolling, which we cannot do unless we get federal blessing from the federal government. Mm-hmm. So we're back to where we started. Either we continue to borrow at a high rate, or we delay projects statewide and all legislators are mad.
I mean, the only other option is if, and this is probably not going to happen, if there's a huge influx of general purpose revenue in the next budget, you could continue transferring money over from that to the transportation fund. The problem is, all of our projections right now are that we're not going to see a huge lift in the budget. Walker did that move recently to try and delay payments on some debt to create a cushion. Maybe he's creating cushion for the next budget to try and hoard every dollar, but you've got Medicaid, which is going to be a big draw.
Yep.
K-12 education. He's now talking about more
a little
resources,
upper for the UW, more
but
resources.
But what's that going to mean?
Yeah.
Is that going to mean that
merit-based additional aid?
So what are additional resources going to be? And then you have roads. Where there's not much money to do all those four things. It's going to be another tough budget, barring a miraculous turnaround of the state's economy in terms of the revenue. And the thing is, revenues are going up, but costs are going up, and we're not keeping pace.
Yeah,
you have like that cushion to do something big and bold.
We aren't. Okay, you and I have got to dodge a few potholes on the way to Green Bay. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for June 3.